welcome to Red Ice Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in today, new and regular listeners. We are glad to have you along. My name is Henrik, and we are currently coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. If you want to know more about our radio program and what we do, head on over to our website, redicecreations.com. And today we have Georgia Lambert with us on the line. She has been in the field of esoteric studies, Eastern and Western disciplines, methods and traditions for over 40 years. She was the first to be licensed by the state of California to teach meditation and esoteric anatomy and physiology, a course which she presented for 3 years at the College of Osteopathic Medicine in the Pacific. In the past, she's served on the board of directors of United Health Resource. For 3 years, she was on the staff at the Institute for Health Facilitation and taught for 2 years for the Institute of Advancement for Human Potential. She's also served on the teaching staff of the Philosophical Research Society under Manly Palmer Hall for about 10 years. I definitely want to talk with Georgia more about this later on as well. I also want to mention that in 1989, she became the first woman to address a Scottish Rite research group on the higher degrees of masonry. In 95, 96, and 97, she also gave presentations to the Pacific Southwest Regional Conclaves of the Rosicrucian Order, the AMORC. And in 2001, she was invited to participate in an ongoing think tank under the umbrella of the Boeing Corporation on the subject of science and education. And her artwork was featured at the Education Summit for the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. So Georgia has definitely been involved in many different disciplines and has a long, long bio. You can read more about this, of course, on her website, lambertslodge.com. That's her personal website. And also, I want to mention that she was also featured in the DVD series The Great Work that we've mentioned before on the program, together with John Anthony West, Lon Milo Duquette, and Art Rosengarten, who we recently had on the show. So you can head into our archives if you want to check out our programs with these guys as well. You can head on over to magicalegypt.com for more information about that DVD series, The Great Work. So with that, it's great to have you with us on the program today, Georgia. Welcome to Red Ice Radio.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much for your time. It's excellent to have you here. We have so much to talk about. I definitely want to get into some of the different disciplines and esoteric traditions, some of the mystery school teachings, as it were, that you've been involved in. But before we do that, briefly for our listeners, maybe we can talk a little bit about your background here at first. You told me in one of your emails that your dad has a background in the military and actually was one of the founders, is that correct, of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization?
Yes, that's right. Actually, on both sides, my family's been military since time out of mind. My parents met at Pearl Harbor, and they were both there that morning. And I was born on St. George's Day in a little field hospital next to Arlington National Cemetery. So I come from a long line of military. During the war, my father was on MacArthur's staff, and then later, after the war, became one of the founders of NATO. So I grew up in France, Italy, and went to high school in Germany.
There you go. So, and also you've been doing, I don't know if that ties in with the military directly, but you've been doing lectures for Boeing and so forth. What were they interested in regards to your work? It seems like a little bit of a strange mix, if you know what I mean.
Well, I was one of many in a particular group that was invited to sort of roundtable and throw out ideas. You know, in the United States, many of the aeronautics companies are realizing that their personnel are retiring and they have no one to replace them with. The school system here is so bad as far as math and science that they're having to import scientists from other countries. And so they need, you know, to get involved in education. And a lot of these companies are making a concerted effort to do just that. And the group that I was involved with was a fairly eclectic group, them trying to think out of the box, as it were, and throwing out ideas as to the state of education, where it needs to go, what it needs to open up to, that kind of thing.
Hmm. Did you introduce any of the more esoteric topics to these people, and did they embrace that or reject that? What was the response?
Not directly, more obliquely, actually. Again, you know, from the artistic sort of right brain side, if you will, of things, recognizing that human beings are more than just their physical life and their feelings and their thoughts, that there has to be some aspiration involved. One of the reasons a lot of young people are not getting into science is they don't want to make bombs, they don't want to make implements of war, and so they go into other fields, and a lot of really brilliant thought is being wasted. So how can we bring in those ideals into the outer life and affairs that stimulate that aspiration once again?
Hmm.
It's very important in the United States as a people to have some kind of vision, some kind of aspiration. And when that's not there, you know, the populace sort of flounders. So it's time to find ways to bring back that that vision and that aspiration that was so much a part of the culture here in the 60s.
What do you feel about, in regards to many of these corporations, that they are, you know, if we talk about Boeing, they are involved in building bombs and so forth. Is that what we should spend our time and energy on? Or do you feel that they need to, you know, begin focus on something else? Or how do you feel working with them, I rather should say? Do you think that you can influence them to get a different mindset, or what's your approach to that question?
Well, there's a lot more aspiration in these areas than one might think. It may not be always on the corporate levels, but it's definitely there within the heart of the people. And certainly there are other avenues besides war implements. There is space, which beckons, you know, and the energy crisis and all of these various things. So, you know, we're not limited to the military. However, I have to say that some of the most ethical, noble people I've ever met have been in the military. In this country, since the Vietnam War, the military has sort of gotten a very bad press, and much of it deserved. However, the military is a valid approach to spirituality, the path of the warrior, which in the past included the Arthurian quest, or in the East, the samurai ethic, is really an important part of the path. In the last age, the attention, as far as spirituality, was given to religion and philosophy. And so that left all of these other areas of human endeavor, such as business, finance, the military, politics. It left these areas open to those which would misuse them, and certainly they did. And so now we're entering an age and a time when spirituality must be brought down to earth and made manifest here. And spiritual workers are now having to re-enter all of these different fields and reclaim them in service to that light within humanity.
Mm. Georgia, tell us a little bit about some of your artwork. I've been looking at your website a little bit, and some of the pictures I really, really like. You're very, very talented. I guess you primarily work with oil, is that correct?
Yes, mm-hmm. Although it's certainly not limited to that. I've done everything from pottery to embroidery to watercolors to everything. But oil is my favorite medium.
Very nice. And continue.
That's all right. I paint in the old Renaissance style of layering color and glazes. And the last rather famous artist to do that was Maxfield Parrish, where each layer was a layer of transparent color. And it bounces the light back and gives a richness that you can't get with a flat paint.
Hmm, interesting. I don't know if that's a trade secret or not, but how do you, I'm interested in this myself because I've been painting a little bit with oil. How do you create those kind of translucent layers that you're talking about?
Well, you start with a white surface. It has to be, you know, a brilliant white. And then each layer of color is almost pure color. It's not mixed, and it's transparent. And it must be completely dry before you add the next layer. In the Renaissance, they sometimes used varnish between the layers, and so it was a very laborious process. But it produces a quality of color that you can't really get in any other way. Maxville Parrish, who is, of course, a famous illustrator, would have 30 paintings going at a time because of the process.
Okay, Georgia, so you've been painting, obviously, a lot, and you've been incorporating this, I guess, into your work as well. And was Boeing in any regard interesting, the lecture you did there and talk? Were they interested in your artwork as a kind of as a force for inspiration as well?
Well, they certainly used some of my graphic work that I designed for a particular conference. And the group that I was involved with under their umbrella was not really a formal group. It was sort of brought in, you know, to the side, as it were. They're very careful about their image, and so exploring other areas is not something they probably want publicized very much.
Really, but strange. But they're interested in it, at least. That's interesting.
Well, let's say that certain individuals are.
Right. And do you think that's they just happen to work within Boeing, so it's not like the Boeing Corporation per se is having type of
But this is true. This is true in many, many areas of business. We're finding that people are hungry for something that gives a deeper meaning and a spiritual component, not necessarily religious. And so that hunger is showing up in corporate America on all different levels.
Mm, interesting. Do you think that this is something we will see continued, the heightened interest in these fields?
Absolutely. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, would anyone have thought that the green movement would have been so popular as it is right now?
Hmm. Good point. Well, it's going to be really interesting seeing where things are going to go in the future in regards to spiritual disciplines in that sense. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background in the Philosophical Research Society as well. I've been following some of the work of Manny Palmer Hall myself. Did you work with him directly or meet him when you were there?
Yes, I was there during the last decade of his life, basically. And he was quite a lovely man, elderly by the time that that I worked there. But in order to teach there, I had an interview with him, and it was rather lengthy. And, you know, it's very interesting. Most of the work that Manly Hall did before the World War was very hard-hitting in terms of getting into alchemy, magical application. And after the war, it became much more philosophical. And he didn't actually endorse or teach techniques. When I came along, I had been teaching for quite some time. And after that interview, I was the first teacher that he allowed to actually teach techniques. And we had a discussion about techniques in that interview. And after that, I taught there for almost 10 years before his untimely death.
Mm, okay. Well, what do you think the reason was why he gave up on some of the more, I guess, hard-hitting esoteric subjects as alchemy and magical techniques? Why did he shift his attention?
I'm certainly not in a position to say why. Who knows? Perhaps the esoteric climate in Southern California had changed by that time. There was a lot of very fringy stuff going on here. I'm sure many of your viewers are aware of the work of Jack Parsons at JPL. And, you know, there was a lot of very strange stuff here in California. And so we have a well-deserved reputation.
Do you think that Manly Palmer Hall got an idea about this, that this type of knowledge were leaking out to other people, other sources who might not be in the best positions, I guess the term is, to have access to this kind of knowledge? Should he got a little bit careful, maybe? What do you think?
I think so. I think that he realized that, you know, that there was a lot of misuse going around, and I think that he didn't want to contribute to that in any way. And certainly his work after that was quite wonderful. I mean, the Philosophical Research Society was quite unique in that it was the one place you could go where you could be exposed to many different traditions and techniques. You know, from the turn of the 1800s to the 1900s on, so many different esoteric groups came to Southern California. You had the Vedanta Society and the Theosophists and Yogananda's Self-Realization Fellowship and just about everything you can possibly think of in all frequency ranges. But the Philosophical Research Society was the one place you could go where, as I said, you could get access to many, many different lineages. And it was quite unique in that respect.
Interesting. And also, from your bio, it said that you were the first woman to address the higher degrees of the Scottish Rite. What's your take on all this thing in regards to Freemasonry and women? I know that there have been specific orders for women, like the Eastern Star, for instance, or Order of Women Freemasons and so forth. But what's your take on this, being a woman and, I guess, at the same time then interested in Freemasonry and dedicated to talk to some of these people?
Well, when you look at the Western mystery traditions, two great pillars on the temple, perhaps, are Masonry and Rosicrucianism. And they actually have different points of origin. Within Freemasonry, of course, you have the heritage of the Knights Templar, the Temple of Solomon story, Kabbalistic to some degree, and also they owe a lot of their symbology not only to the Old Testament, but to the traditions of Mithras, which was a very early Roman, coming out of Persia actually, but Roman initiatory system. And in all of these systems, it was a male-only tradition. So it was pretty understandable that Masonry would continue in that line. The Rosicrucians, on the other hand, go back to alchemy and some of the Egyptian mysteries, and they always included women. And so they're just different lineages. And when you understand their background, you understand why they are the way they are today, although that's probably going to have to change in the future.
Tell us more about that. What do you think that, I guess we can term it then, regular Freemasonry is going to allow more women in? Is that where you think things are going?
Who knows whether they will or not, but, you know, when the evolutionary stream begins to find you, if you don't move out of the way or go with it, it simply goes around you. And so we're seeing a lot more co-Masonic orders of all different types. There are French and Belgian lodges, which include women. The thing is, the all-female lodges are just as sectarian and separative as the male lodges. So that's not necessarily a right balance or help. We need to have integrated lodges with the recognition that regardless of the particular body we're in, we're all fellow souls, and our relationship with each other should be on that basis.
Do you think that this certain traditions and certain types of knowledge should be opened up to more people in general, or do you think it's a kind of... it's still a purpose, so to speak, for some of this more esoteric knowledge to be secret or behind closed doors, so to speak?
Well, you know, the Bible says that things are there for those that have eyes to see and ears to hear. And the true mysteries have always been accessible. It's just people don't recognize them. When we talk about secret societies, which is a very hot topic these days because of movies and recent books, we have to realize that there is a balance in the world, you know. Sometimes it swings a little far to one end or the other, but there's always that balance. And one of the difficulties that we see today with all of the popularity about secret societies is they're always seen in the negative. And just because something's secret doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad or dark. To play devil's advocate for a moment, suppose you knew that we were coming into a time when all secrets would be revealed, that because of the magnetic pull of human attention, all this information, all of these ways and means to evolve oneself begins to rise to the surface. And let's just say you serve those forces that want to keep humanity asleep. You want to preserve the status quo. And yet you know that everything's coming to the surface. Everything's going to be revealed. A very effective strategy would be to not try to stop that because you couldn't. But what you could do is put it out there that all of these mysteries are dark and bad. That would be a very effective strategy for keeping humanity away from them and keeping humanity asleep. So recognize that just because something's secret doesn't mean that it's dark, that there has always been that company within humanity that has guarded, served, and defended the light within humanity. And just because they're not as well known on the surface doesn't mean they're not there.
Do you think there is a kind of, in regards to what you just said, as a kind of preface, do you think that there is conscious dissemination of this type of information at this particular time? Again, you mentioned certain movies we don't have to mention. I think most people are aware now what is happening. Many popular movies and books that are released are beginning to go into these different areas. Do you think that this is being put out there with a specific intention?
I think in many cases, yes. Not necessarily the specific filmmakers or authors, but I think that there's a tidal stream of movement happening within humanity. Humanity is demanding answers to the problems that it faces in terms of how do we survive as a planet? How do we take that next initiatory step? And so the answers are coming through all kinds of different means. It's sort of like, you know, in the Arthurian tradition, the Grail Knight's job was not to find the solution. The Grail Knight's job was to ask the right question. Because when you ask the right question, when you formulate it clearly and precisely, you establish a relationship with the answer. And that answer can come in a variety of different ways. It can come through inspiration. It can come through the arts. It can come through the talents of human beings that are simply responding to their own higher self, their own inspiration, in a variety of different ways. So I think that, as Sherlock Holmes used to say, the game is afoot, and the movement is happening, and it's gaining power, and it's gaining speed, and the forces that would keep humanity asleep are scrambling to try to keep everything down, but it's too much. It can't be done. So we're on our way.
We're on our way. Go ahead.
I'm very hopeful about the future, regardless of what we see happening on the surface. I think that there is worldwide aspiration as never before, and that is a tremendous power factor for the manifestation of better systems.
And we don't have to spend too much time on this, but I want to ask you, in regards to these forces that you do mention, is there anything, do you attribute these to certain people, certain organizations? Is there anything you want to put a name on for people who want to search for their own sake about this and try to figure out what's going on?
Not really, and I'll tell you why. Anytime you have an organization composed of human beings, you're going to have both light and dark. And so to try to say any one organization is all bad or any one organization is all good simply isn't the truth. We're all human beings, and therefore we're a mix, and everything we create is a mix. Also, one of the things that's happening today with the mystery traditions is that the traditional esoteric schools are at sort of a quandary. You know, in the past, there were two basic levels of the mysteries. There were the mysteries of the outer court, which are principles, mostly moral and ethical principles, that should be taught by religion. And if people actually practice the heart of their own religion, it would take them to the place where the greater mysteries can actually be worked. The problem with some of the esoteric schools today is that the candidate coming to them is far more sophisticated than the candidate of the immediate past. You know, 20 years ago, you didn't have on the corner bookstores that had a New Age or metaphysical section. You know, I can speak for here in California, in the 60s, if you wanted to find a metaphysical bookstore, you were hard-pressed to do so. And the books that you would find in there, you actually had to have a mind to be able to read them. And today, of course, you have vast New Age sections, vast self-help sections. Some of it's fluff, but that's okay. Everybody's got to start somewhere. And so by the time a candidate would seek out a mystery school, they've already done some of the inner work that used to be required. And so the beginning grades of a lot of these schools are sort of out of touch and very boring, and people get bored and leave, which is part of the problem. Another thing is that all of these different mystery schools, particularly the Western schools, which had to be so veiled in symbology because of the Inquisition during the Middle Ages, the Western schools each have their own techniques, each have their own lineages, their traditions, and all of those things built in certain things within the candidate. The problem is that now it's time to share. Now it's time for all of these different traditions, which have served nobly, to bring forth the fruits of their labor and put all of their stuff on the table so that we can have a whole complete peace. And they don't know how to do that. They don't know how to talk to one another. The theosophists don't want to talk to the anthroposophists, and they don't want to talk to the Ellis Bailey people, and they don't want to talk to, you know, the Masons, and the Buddhists really don't care, and so nobody's talking to anybody else. And so this is a great problem within the esoteric community.
Do you think that that needs to be done at this point, that these different fields and disciplines needs to converge in some way and begin to cooperate for, I guess, what you term then the next evolutionary leap in regards to human consciousness?
Absolutely, because no one system has all of it. It's sort of like a great medallion that's been broken in pieces, and every tradition has a piece, and they do all fit together. And some questions in one system may be answered by another system. And until you have that kind of integration, everyone stays a sort of separate entity. We need a new modern round table where American Indian elders can sit and talk with higher-ups of Rosicrucian systems or Masonry or Theosophy or Buddhism. And that has yet to happen.
Is that something that you want to do?
Oh, I couldn't bring it off myself, but I would certainly lend my capabilities to that kind of endeavor.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about esoteric anatomy and physiology. This is something that was mentioned in your bio. Tell us a little bit about this, if you will.
Well, esoteric anatomy and physiology has to do with the study of the subtle body that underlies the physical body, that, of course, in the 60s became somewhat known in the West through the technology of Curlyant photography, among other things, and of course the research of Thelma Moss at UCLA. In the East, they've always had these particular traditions that teach about the subtle body and its organs, which they call chakras, and of course have depicted as energy centers of revolving wheels of energy with differing numbers of spokes, or they show them on charts as lotus blossoms of differing numbers of petals. And there are many sciences dealing with the movement of energies from lower centers or chakras into higher ones. The difficulty is that there are far more than 7 major chakras. There are 21 minor centers and 49 minute centers, and these don't usually figure into the texts that are available to the public. Now, the Western traditions also have this science, but it's in a completely different symbolic language. In the West, the chakras or centers were often depicted as metals or planets or mythological animals. And so you have to know what you're reading in a lot of these stories in order to really understand what's being said. If one studies the Greek myths, one can gain a lot of very interesting information in terms of the process of initiation, particularly the labors of Hercules, for instance, or the Odyssey would be another one. But those are just a couple of examples. The Arthurian tradition would be another. If one studied the specifics of each knight that sat on the round table, each one could be seen as an astrological initiation, but also as a movement through the center system.
Interesting. And would you, I've heard people even incorporate actually psychology into this. I think even Freud did some kind of work in regards to decoding psychological processes and complex of the human being in regards to the Greek mythological record. Have you heard about that?
Mostly I'm more familiar with the work that Jung did in alchemy, and of course the universal archetypes. He did a lot in this particular area. But again, you know, the Western mystery traditions had to be much more circumspect because of the Inquisition. And so the Arthurian myths were distributed through the troubadours, and it was a whole secret system, and yet it was out in the open. If you look at the art in the Renaissance, some of those masters got a whole bunch of stuff right under the nose of the church, if one knows how and where to look. One of the things that really helped me as a child was for bedtime stories. My brother and I got Egyptian history, Greek myths, Norse myths, so we had quite a background to sort of launch from in terms of esoteric study. In some of the Masonic degrees, particularly the Royal Arch degree, if one studies the mythological stories about certain constellations, you know, if you have a star chart that shows the North Star in the center, and then it shows all of the various constellations, not just the 12, actually 13 of our zodiac, but it shows all of the constellations. And then it shows the Milky Way across that. The Milky Way is like a starry bridge that goes from one side of the star chart to the other. And at the very top of that arch, you have constellations such as Cephas, the king, and Andromeda, and the whole story of the rescue of Andromeda by Perseus. All of these are very, very meaningful in terms of initiation. So one could teach the Western mysteries through a variety of symbolic languages.
Interesting. Would you say that that's why so many people are and have been fascinated by Greek mythology. I can only think back on myself, for instance. I was always interested in reading these books when I was little, and what I, the only way I can kind of explain that is that there is some kind of, I don't know how to word it really, but resonance going on between me and the thing that I'm reading. It's just something that triggers, if you know what I mean, in the person who's reading it. Or what do you think is going on there, or why is it so interesting?
Well, these myths deal with, mentioned before, those archetypal images that Jung talked about that have an effect upon our consciousness. And the Greek myths are the most commonly known because, of course, the Romans borrowed from the Greeks and just changed the names a bit, but the stories were the same. But these same stories can be found in Celtic mythology or Norse mythology or any world mythology, really. It's all the same story. If you know what the story is, then you can see how the language on the surface gives it this particular coloring in this particular culture or that particular coloring in that particular culture, but it's really all the same.
Interesting. And again, you mentioned some of the problems, I guess, that the West has had with this. Was this not the case in regards to Eastern traditions, or did they have, after certain points, other religious, ideals to wrestle with, so to speak? And do you think that Islam or Muslim has been suppressing some of this knowledge, or have they actually welcomed this knowledge in one way? What's your take on that?
Well, every religious tradition has its secret heart. One of the things that I tell my students is, suppose, for instance, that God spoke to you in your prayer or meditation tonight, and God said to you, your job, and you can't leave incarnation until you get it done, your job is to produce harmony and peace between the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh, God.
how would you go about that? Well, obviously, the Mormons aren't going to listen to what the Jehovah's Witnesses have to say, and they're not going to listen to what the Mormons have to say, and neither one of them want to listen to what you have to say. So how would you do it? Well, you would turn each to the very heart of their own system, because the heart is the same for all. It's only when you get out on the edge and get caught in the forms and the books and the trappings that people don't recognize one another. It's like climbing a mountain. The mountaintop is the same for all. We all start from a very different base. And when we start at our particular base, we can't see one another. But as we get closer to the top, we also get closer to one another. Now, in terms of what's going on today with Islam, those that have studied the Mithraic and Persian traditions and the Sufi traditions, I mean, it's there. The problem is that as a religion, it's fairly new. When we look at the three great Western religions that are fighting to the death in the Middle East these days, the Jewish tradition is far older. And if you read the Old Testament, there was a time when they were going around slaying everybody. You know, this was the time of a jealous God that could brook no other gods before him. And it was quite militant and suppressive. Christianity, which came along much later, went through its adolescence during the Middle Ages with the Crusades. And Christianity did the same thing with the Crusades and the Inquisition. Well, now it's just Islam's turn. They're going through the same cycle that every religion goes through as a religion moves from its infancy into adolescence toward maturity. But the esoteric heart there is the same. Of course, the difficulty is getting through the teenage period, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. And also, when you mentioned this, I'm reminded about the possible idea that I want to ask you, rather, do you think that this also needs to be updated? What I'm saying is, bring in the same mythology again, but wrap it up in a more kind of modern story to get more people interested? Or you still think that the old stories are sufficient, so to speak, to do the work?
Oh, that's a great question. The short answer is yes and no. Certainly we can study the old stories and they still work. However, up until fairly recently, the mystery schools really were on the cutting edge of human thought. The mystery in the mystery schools has to do with self-initiated evolution. In other words, evolving faster than the masses around you. And the techniques that were taught in the mystery schools were toward this end, how to move into one's own self-initiated growth and development in a spiritual sense. So the mystery schools in recorded history were always on the cutting edge of this thought. In the last 50 to 100 years, this is no longer so. The mystery schools have been eclipsed by what's going on in science, particularly in the new areas of physics. And I'll give you some examples. We know that time, for instance, is not a constant. This was played with in theory in the early 1900s, late 1800s, by artists, by scientists, by authors. But we know today, and we can prove it, that time moves different, let's say, for the astronauts than it does when you're on solid Earth. We know that time moves different when you're dreaming or when you have an out-of-body or astral experience, when you have a near-death experience. So this is no longer just theory. It's been proven that time isn't a constant. Well, if you understand that, and then you look at the teachings of the traditional mystery traditions that teach about reincarnation or karma, for instance, all of that has to be rethought, because if time isn't what we think it is, then you have to open to the possibility that from the angle of the soul, there is only one incarnation or one sojourn in matter. And all of the so-called incarnations are the fingers to the palm of the hand. They are the extensions of the soul outward in many times and places. And they're, from the angle of the soul, going on simultaneously. Now, if you let your brain play with that, then you have to rethink how karma works. And you realize that karma and reincarnation are not linear processes. Our brains are taught to think in a linear three-dimensional way. Doesn't mean they can't think in more expanded ways, but they're not taught how to. So the mystery traditions that are teaching things like reincarnation and karma in this linear way are way out of step. And I think that where science is going in this next stage is going to give us not only the old concepts in a completely new way, but it may give us a new language whereby all of these esoteric traditions can begin to talk to one another.
That sounds very, very interesting. And, you know, Georgia, I'd love to talk more about some of these other things that you've been into, like the Kabbalah, a little bit more about alchemy later on here in the member section. But before we wrap things up here for our first segment, Georgia, I'd like to talk a little bit about your website and also please tell us about the online class that you're about to start up, Georgia.
Yes, I've been teaching for well over 30 years, and I teach beginning classes and I teach advanced classes. And I have a new class just ready to start in a couple of weeks. And if anyone is interested in that, they can contact me through my website, which is www.lambertslodge.com, and I'll be happy to email them information. And I teach live and in real time, which means that when it's time for class, they go to my website and they will have the ability to see and hear me and interact with me. And I know that that I'm on California time, but if there is a big enough interest in the European community, I would be happy to organize a class that is conducive to their hours.
Very good. And do you have more in regards to specifically what you'll be going into, or will you? Is this more participatory in the sense that you take it where the students want to go as well, or how does it work?
No, the new class coming up is a very specific training. It's a long-term training in internal discipline and the initiatory path. The class is structured so that the student will work with one technique for a while, and that will build in certain things. And then they go on to a more advanced technique. And so it's a progressive kind of experience. And with the instruction and practice in various techniques, there's also a whole section on esoteric anatomy and physiology, planetary history, the mystic side of Christianity, all kinds of subjects that you would normally find in mystery school traditions.
Very good. And again, the website is lambertslodge.com. They can read more about Georgia's background, some of the work she's going into, and also some of these online classes that will be upcoming, of course. But I also want to mention here before we round things up about the DVD, The Great Work. You can head on over to the website magicalegypt.com if you want to check out some of the teasers. And if you do want to get a copy, you can type in Georgia, I guess, will be the name in the coupon code box, and get a 25% discount. To talk with Vanisi, who is the producer of the series, and for everyone out there who is interested, can simply type in Georgia. I will have this information as well up on the website. But beyond that, Georgia, is there anything you want to mention about the series? I've really enjoyed it. I think that Chance Gardner and Vanisi did a great job. What do you think?
Oh, I do too. And when they first told me about the project, it sounded like a really exciting thing to do. It's time that some of these Western mystery traditions were at least exposed to the public. You know, you go into so many metaphysical bookstores and you see wonderful books about Eastern tradition, but not a lot about the West. The stuff that's about the West is more in the mythological section, but actually there are Western traditions and techniques that involve practice. And that's really what it's all about, because when you die, you're not going to take your tapes and your notebooks and your libraries with you. You're only going to take what you build within yourself, within your own consciousness. And so the purpose of the Mystery School is to do that internal building.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Georgia, for this first segment. Let's take a short break here, tune into some music, and then we'll be right back after this break. Tune into our continuation with Georgia Lambert. For our members, we will talk more about the chakra points and the relationship to different mythological animals and their properties. We'll also talk about spiritual alchemy, the functions of the brain, progression of consciousness, relaxation, visualization, and other techniques. But we will begin to talk about the true third eye. Georgia has a different interpretation than the popular idea that the pineal gland is the third eye. So head on over to redeyescreations.com, where you can find more information about how to sign up and tune in. We will talk more on the flip side.
All the two white lines. jealous spies. Got telephones for eyes. Come to you as friends. All those endless ends that can't be tied. That never were quite right.